supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Several prominent men accused in recent months of sexual harassment, including Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey, have said that they are either in counseling or seeking evaluation and treatment for their behavior. But some companies actually provide treatment for employees accused of misconduct. Let's learn more with WHYY's Nina Feldman. Nina, you talked to one psychologist who works with accused harassers.
That's right. So just imagine that you're a higher up at a big Fortune 500 company, and you hear about some sexual harassment complaints about one of your top executives. But this guy's really valuable to the company. Maybe he even started the company, and you honestly think he might be able to change. So rather than firing him, some companies bring in someone like Sarah Bridges. She's a corporate psychologist and an executive coach, and she works with men at companies across the country to see if she can help turn things around.
The big question, of course, is can she help turn things around? Does counseling or coaching really work?
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, too. So to give me an idea of how it all works, Sarah walked me through a couple of examples with executives she'd coached right here in Philadelphia that had varying degrees of success. So one note before we start, we won't be using the names of any of Sarah's clients. About 2 years ago, Sarah got a call from the HR department at a large healthcare company in Philadelphia. A bunch of women had filed complaints about a top executive there.
Stroking their back, grabbing their arms, hugging them even when people didn't want to be hugged.
HR looked into it and found the claims were valid.
He was at a party once and pulled a woman onto his lap. It was videotaped, as corporate functions often are.
So HR called Sarah. Her first step is always a long interview with the executive to find out what he says happened. Next, she does a series of tests.
Testing for personality traits like impulsivity, empathy, personal insight, and so on, to really try to understand what underneath is driving some of these behaviors.
Sarah says there are a few different traits she looks out for.
One common one is somebody who's quite low on what we kind of call casually EQ or emotional intelligence. So they're aware of what they're intending to do and assume that lines up with how people perceive them, and it often doesn't.
Another trait she sees a lot is impulsivity, people who care about their impact but are bad at controlling their behavior. So Sarah did her interview and ran her battery of tests on this healthcare exec.
Talking to him, it was really clear that he did care about this issue and was quite mortified that the women had been so upset by his behavior. He saw himself as a mentor. He did indeed mentor a lot of women along the way and cared a lot. His empathy was high.
But she says he lacked self-awareness and he was impulsive. Sarah interviewed the women who'd complained about him and read him their statements anonymously so he could understand how he'd made them feel. They met every other week for 6 months. Together, they came up with a plan.
In his case, it was quite black and white. No hugging, no touching, period.
They decided that at first, he couldn't even be alone in a room with a woman. Between their sessions, Sarah checked in with his coworkers so they could let her know
if they see anything that seems to be relapse.
Once the 6 months were up, Sarah stayed in touch with the company. It's been about 2 years since she was called in, and so far, she says, there have been no more complaints. But cases like this one are the exception, not the rule. More often than not, Sarah says her coaching sessions go more like this.
Right out of the gate, it was looking dubious.
This was with another Philadelphia executive, this one at a consulting firm. He'd been sending sexually inappropriate texts to coworkers and to clients.
I had the long interview with him. He spent the whole time telling me why other people in the firm did the same behavior, why women should be discredited that had come forward, and so on.
But the executives who brought him in said he was very important to the firm. So even though she had a bad feeling about it, Sarah gave it a try.
And part of the problem with some personalities like his is they are pretty sophisticated and slippery in terms of knowing what to say at the right time and really being duplicitous.
Sure enough, after about a month, Sarah says the guy was sending racy texts to a client again. HR found the messages on his work phone and fired him. With most cases ending like this, it seems like this work could be really disheartening.
Well, and this may be a horrible analogy, but it's a little bit like being an oncologist. You know, you start with people who are quite ill, and so the odds are already difficult for them to turn this around.
Sarah says she considers it a success if 30% of her clients don't relapse within a year. As for that 70%, well, here's how she thinks about it. While the executives are Sarah's clients, so are the companies they work for. She sees these interventions as a chance to make a culture change.
This, you know, sacred cow, senior executive, everyone knows no one will ever fire Bob, gets fired. That can be a real turning point. It can be the time that the organization starts down a different road.
Sarah thinks of her job as doing more than just trying to change the bad actor.
When we're in groups and something happens, whether it's someone falling down and looking injured or sexual harassment, we tend to stand around and assume somebody else is going to do something that is human nature. We all are part of calling out behaviors that cross a line, not expecting someone else will, not standing by and letting it happen.
Nina, how is Sarah's business doing in the hashtag MeToo era?
Her business has been doing quite well. She estimates that workplace harassment calls have quadrupled since last year, and she says people are just thinking about this issue differently right now.
One scenario I just had recently, we've heard for years rumors that, you know, he can be a little inappropriate on business trips with female colleagues, but no one's ever come forward. Well, for years and years, they did nothing. In this environment right now, I got a call about this. That's not okay anymore.
Thanks, Nina.
You're welcome.
WHYY's Nina Feldman. She spoke with corporate psychologist Sarah Bridges. Did Donald Trump's speeches inspire violence along the campaign trail? Several researchers at Penn tackled that question recently and published their findings last week. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron reports on what they found.
Christopher Morrison and his colleagues research injury prevention.
So we're always looking out for potential contributors to violence and injury.
Politics and violence aren't exactly strangers, but Morrison, a postdoctoral fellow, wanted to check the hypothesis that Donald Trump rallies specifically led to violence.
There was often the suggestion made that the inflammatory rhetoric from then-candidate Trump was leading to increased incidents of violence.
You might recall some of that inflammatory rhetoric.
Maybe he should have been roughed up.
Get the hell out of here!
I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
Morrison and his co-authors looked at cities that hosted Trump rallies during the campaign and compared them with cities where his opponent, Hillary Clinton, appeared. After controlling for population size and other variables, they found cities where Trump held rallies experienced a 12% uptick in assaults that same day. They don't know why exactly. Perhaps increased police presence led to more vigilance and arrests. But Morrison believes
the most likely explanation is that the Trump rallies themselves lead to violence.
How exactly? It could be the extra assaults happened at or around Trump rallies. It could be that people heard Trump's words on local news or social media and it shifted their moods. But for Morrison, the lesson is simple. Words matter. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHY.
Events are scheduled through the fall, celebrating the centennial of the Benjamin Franklin Parkway in Philadelphia. Joining me now is David Brownlee. The second edition of his book was just released. It's called Building the City Beautiful, the Benjamin Franklin Parkway and the Philadelphia Museum of Art. David, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
It's a pleasure.
It's a magnificent book that is in large measure a historical account. And let's see, it started back in the 19th century, the proposal to build this.
It began right after the Civil War, as Fairmount Park was being created. The desire to connect the largest industrial city in the world to what they aimed to make the largest park system in the world was part of the city's collective imagination during this period of time.
It was called the City Beautiful Movement. Explain.
Yes. Well, the City Beautiful Movement was the first, I think you could say, distinctively American contribution to city planning. And it reshaped many American cities in the late 19th century on the model of Paris. Paris was sometimes called the capital of the 19th century. It was certainly the artistic capital of the 19th century, and it had remade itself in the 1850s and 1860s, cutting apart its old medieval core with new boulevards, and American cities aspired to do the same thing.
Of course, that plan proceeded by fits and starts. Merely 1 year later, there was a financial collapse, and that parked the plans for at least a decade.
No, it was a very slow evolutionary process that finally began with demolition in 1907. And even when that began, the Parkway plan had not been agreed upon. They paused and readjusted it, resumed, and finally completed the paving between Fairmount, the Reservoir Hill that became the site of the Art Museum, and the base of City Hall Tower. They finally completed that paving in 1918, and that's why we're celebrating the centennial this year.
In its original iteration, which of the iconic buildings lined the Parkway?
The simple truth is that there were no buildings lining the Parkway as it began, because it was largely a project of dreams to bring together institutions that very slowly did assemble there. The dream was, in fact, to replace an industrial zone with a zone devoted to art and commerce and culture. It was not a shining, gleaming example of a wonderful neighborhood, and there wasn't much of a quarrel about taking it down. But when people looked at the Parkway in 1917 and 1918, I think they would have been a little bit appalled at what they had created, because an enormous emptiness had been created.
It was a decade later that the Free Library of Philadelphia was established there.
The Free Library opened finally in 1927. It was the first new public building to open on the Parkway. And that was, in fact, 16 years after the architects for the building had been hired. A very long and slow project, and just the first of the great projects to be completed.
Speak specifically to one of the architects involved with that project, who was apparently the nation's most prominent African-American architect.
Philadelphia can be proud. The University of Pennsylvania can be proud. The Free Library of Philadelphia can be proud. That Julian Abel, the first African-American graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's architecture program. And I think in the first decades of the 20th century, the most prominent African-American architect in the country, that Julian Abel was the principal designer of the Free Library. And it was a building that I think can be said to embody his artistic ideals very distinctively.
Part of the zigzagging to get from plan to implementation was caused by one Mr. Widener, who prevailed upon the mayor to consider changing the route.
An important role throughout the history of the Parkway was played by Peter Widener, the city's greatest art collector. Back in the 1890s, he had offered to build an art museum if the city would simply build a boulevard to it. And when it looked like the Parkway was actually literally going to zigzag in order to reduce the cost of acquiring property, Widener was among those who demanded that the city take a better look at it. They called in a group of experts, and not surprisingly, the expert told them that the best route would be a straight line. Sadly, in the end, the museum was not built fast enough to satisfy him. He died before the collection could be transferred, and ultimately his son gave his collection to the National Gallery in Washington, D.C.
The Parkway is a joy to all who visit it, either impromptu or for scheduled events, sometimes less so for residents in the Art Museum and Fairmount districts, and I suppose it's hard to break through those understandable tensions.
Oh, I think it's an enormous and difficult problem that we Philadelphians have to figure out how to solve. I mean, the Parkway was designed for parades. It wasn't designed as a concert venue. It was designed for a place where a long linear procession could make its way through admiring throngs. There is really no appropriate place on it for a huge crowd to gather and listen to a performance or a speech. That's the great challenge. I can only hope that in the thinking that we're putting into the area around the sports stadiums in South Philadelphia, or in thinking about the Delaware River waterfront, there'll be an opportunity to create a more suitable place for large gatherings of people.
Thank you, in turn, for bringing to life the history and lore of the Ben Franklin Parkway and Philadelphia Museum of Art.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
David Brownlee is author of Building the City Beautiful, the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, and the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The second edition is just released to time with the ongoing centennial celebrations along the Parkway. A West Philadelphia man is raising money to give guns to children. But it's not what you think, as WHYY's Dana DeFilippo explains.
Gabriel Nyantache loves water guns. The West Philly man loved them so much as a child that he became an avid collector and even has a tattoo of a Super Soaker on his stomach. Now he's raising money to give water guns to children in Philadelphia and Chicago, two cities plagued by gun violence. He calls his campaign Water Arms Over Firearms. Besides bringing kids joy, he's trying to redefine guns at a time when shootings are all over the news. Water guns have a metaphorical power, he says, that he hopes can counter some of the damage real guns have done.
It's just the idea of like a gun that shoots the thing that is the essence of life, that can give life as something that, you know, is destructive. I just thought that it's like there's like a poetry there, and that's like a message of like hope that I'd wanted to share.
The Super Soaker, he says, holds special meaning for communities of color because it was invented by Lonnie Johnson, a former NASA engineer who's African American.
That's also inspiration for me that it was this black scientist who developed this, you know, a gun that changed the world in a positive way. I'm just proud that a black man did this, and it's a positive thing because, you know, he was able to bring joy to a lot of people.
With the shooting in Parkland, Florida, still a fresh wound, some say now is not the time to give away fake guns.
You don't want to be encouraging necessarily belligerent play between young people. And things that actually shoot projectiles, I think, could do that.
That's the Reverend Robert Moore, who heads the New Jersey-based Coalition for Peace Action. He points to places like Ridgewood, New Jersey, where a school district has discouraged students from playing an annual Nerf gun battle they worry could be misconstrued or cause panic. Still, Moore remembers how much fun he had playing with water guns as a child.
I got in trouble when I brought a squirt gun to my high school, I think on the last day of school. I did enjoy squirt guns when I was that age. So I can see that they're fun, especially in the warm weather.
Maybe, he says, the key is keeping Super Soakers away from schools. Nyantache understands the sensitivity to guns, even plastic water blasters that look nothing like the real thing.
Well, people don't get it initially.
But for those people, Nyantache has piles of pictures of smiling, soaking wet children who he's already armed with water guns. And if that's not enough proof, he'd like to invite you to a water gun fight that he promises will end with lots of laughs. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
The lion may not yet be in full retreat, but the lamb will loom larger early tomorrow afternoon. Let's march forward with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, we're fast approaching a sure sign of spring.
Vernal equinox arrives tomorrow at 12:15, just a few minutes after noon, which is sort of different because we're typically used to having, you know, it start either early in the day or late in the day. But we start right in the middle so we can enjoy the last half day of winter.
What precisely happens at 12:15?
Well, it's actually when the Earth reaches a specific point in its orbit around the Sun that we identify this as the vernal equinox. That's really what it is. At that point, the Earth's rotational axis is oriented in such a way that we end up with equal hours of daylight and darkness right around this time.
And the good news is, even if there is another snowfall or three, it will perhaps melt quicker with the radiation.
Well, that's the really cool thing about this, is the way that orientation goes for us is that the rays of light we're getting from the sun for us are much more direct. So the heating that happens goes up dramatically. As time goes on, we also have many more minutes of sunlight, so this portion of the Earth is heating faster also.
The sun is much, much less a factor all the way out of the dwarf planet Ceres. But I understand there are new developments even there.
While it may be less of a factor, it's still having an effect nonetheless. And when we consider that as Ceres orbits around the sun, it's a dwarf planet like the other dwarf planet of our solar system, Pluto, and like the other planets, it orbits around the sun. During that circuit, since the orbit is not circular but elliptical, there are points at which that object is closer to the sun than others. So what happens is it actually does have seasons related to its own axial tilt and things like that. What happens, though, is the additional heating that occurs on Ceres reveals the presence of water there someplace. So we now are pretty sure, given the data that comes to us from the Dawn spacecraft that's been orbiting that dwarf planet since 2015, there's probably a significant amount of water frozen into the soil and maybe even layers frozen into the soil just beneath the surface.
Seasons, but those seasons are a lot longer than our Earth's one-year orbit.
Well, they are, because we're now talking about an object that's out beyond the orbit of Mars, so we know it's going to be longer than the two-year orbit that Mars has. But we can certainly see in the data that comes from Dawn that we can observe places where we find water frozen into cliff walls of craters that are hidden from sunlight. We also find that there are cryovolcanoes of what seems to be some sort of a slurry-like material, slushy-like substance. Now, the next questions we have to ask, is there some kind of a water cycle of a liquid or maybe an evaporative type of substance? Then that also leads to the ultimate question always of what's the possibility for environments that may have been conducive to the development of life at some point.
Lastly, did we miss this NASA launch? Did they send a giant bottle of Visine out to Jupiter to get rid of that great red spot?
I think we did miss that. As it turns out, that giant bottle of Visine might have come from the planet itself. You know, the great red spot that we've been observing out at Jupiter since we've been observing Jupiter with a telescope some 400 years or more, that red spot seems to be changing. And this is one of the things we always have to remember about the solar system is that things are dynamic. There's always some change going on. Now it turns out that over the last 150 years, we've watched as the red spot has been shrinking. And the thinking is perhaps ultraviolet radiation from the sun, that UV is causing it to fade out from red to much more of an intense orange color. We'll have to keep watching to see what happens in the evolution over time. We know that there are other spots on Jupiter that we can see in the atmosphere. But who knows? Maybe the great red spot will eventually disappear altogether.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.